chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them, but we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. I'm your host, Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing. It's August. For me, that usually means that my favorite day of the year is right around the corner. No, it's not Labor Day. It's the first day of school. The smell of new books, new Sharpie stains on my clothes, and the opportunity to go back and see our friends. The first day of school this year is going to be a bit different, to say the least, a bit controversial, to say the absolute least. But we here at Rom-Com Killjoys want to celebrate this favorite season of ours by taking you back for a month of back-to-school rom-coms. And here to discuss the first of our back-to-school rom-coms is a returning guest, my pal, Maida Marston. Maida, will you remind the people about yourself?
Hi. Yes, I am a theater director, was based in Washington, D.C. I am now headed up to New York as soon as this pandemic nonsense dies down and, you know, whatever happens in the future happens.
Yeah, we're still, I don't think we thought when we started making this podcast that we would still have so many questions about what was happening.
So many questions, yeah. And what's funny is I'm in Georgia right now where schools have opened. So there's definitely a very bizarre back-to-school spirit happening here right now.
Yes, we are here to kill your joy about rom-coms, and we're also here to kill your joy about going back to school if you had any left.
Exactly.
Well, Maida, this was a movie that you recommended to us very early on in the days of this podcast. What movie are we talking about this week?
We are talking about the first movie of the soon-to-be trilogy, To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which this is the name I always get mixed up, so I just call it To All the Boys.
How do you get it mixed up? What are the other versions of it that you say?
Oh, no. What if I called it? I'm like, All the Boys I've Ever Loved, or, you know, To All the Boys I've Ever Known, To All the Boys I've Ever Met, you know.
I feel like To All the Boys I've Ever Met is some kind of skeezy porn parody of this movie, and I don't want to consider
that. Don't put that out there.
If one doesn't exist yet, there's a free idea for you, internet. All right, yes, the movie we're talking about this week, To All the Boys I've Loved Before, The Year of Our Lord, 2018. Here is your plot summary. Laura Jean Covey, played by Lana Condor, lives a normal, boring high school life until some unexpected letters get released to all of her former crushes. These were love letters that were meant for her eyes only, until one day her sister Kitty sends them out in hopes to give Laura Jean a more interesting life. At school, her life is thrown into turmoil when these boys start to approach her about their letters. Among these boys are Josh, who happens to be her next-door neighbor, and her older sister Margot's boyfriend, and Peter Kavinsky, played by Noah Centineo, her arch-nemesis, Jen's boyfriend. Throughout some very unusual events, Laura Jean finds herself, and maybe even, a real relationship. Well, Maida, that's what the internet says To All the Boys I've Loved Before is about. But what do you say this movie is really about?
I mean, I would say that that's a pretty good synopsis, but it does... I think it's really interesting that there are going to be three movies, and the first and second one have come out, and they're based on books, so you can tell when you've already seen the second movie that in the books there's a much longer story trajectory, and this is really just the first chapter, and so you're like, oh yeah, like that's how they introduce the story, but there's so much more to come, you know? So yeah, it gives you enough to be like, oh, I'd like to watch this movie.
Well, I think there's also something that I think is central to these films and also to the cultural conversation around them that is left out of this summary that I think is relevant to you, and I know something that's important to you is that
this is
a rare teen rom-com where the central character is one, a girl of color, and two, an Asian girl.
Yeah, so I think one of the, for me, my favorite thing about this movie is that it's about a girl who is half Korean, half white, and you get to see her family. And I think her family is, like, the most special part of this movie because she, the synopsis mentions her younger sister, and I guess it mentions her older sister as well, but it's three sisters, and Laura Jean is the middle child. The middle child is always, like, the one that everyone likes to focus on. So she's kind of the focus of this movie. And then she's got her father, who's played by...
John Corbin.
John Corbin, who's lovely in this part, and is their father, who is so loving and so wonderful, and tries really hard to help them maintain a connection to their Korean culture, which I think is, like, one of the most lovely kind of, like, just, like, little tidbits that they stick into the movie, that he tries to make Korean food, and, like, takes them regularly to the Korean grocery store that's all the way across town. So that's kind of, like, a lovely part of this story.
Yeah, and I think it's really nice, too, that there's a... This is a rare example, I think, of a film where the family is, one, a mixed family, as you say, mm-hmm. But also a mixed family that acknowledges cultural difference as a fact rather than something that you have to hide or yes. something that you have to pretend doesn't occur in mixed families. And I love that that is not a conflict in the plot, really, but it is something that helps you understand Laura Jean, and especially her relationship to her mother, who's passed away.
Yes. Yeah, and how she, I guess, relates to her sisters, and especially, like, her older sister, Margot, and her youngest sister, who was, like, so young when their mother passed away.
Yeah, it's just part of the, it's part of the larger kind of way that their family relates to each other, which seems very realistic to me. How does it seem to you?
Yeah, I mean, I love that one of the first scenes of the movie when they're kind of having a, almost like a goodbye dinner for her older sister, Margot, who's about to go to college in Scotland, of all places. And her dad has made some Korean dish. I don't think it's bulgogi, but it's some Korean meat dish. And he is struggling hard, and it does not go well. And he's clearly not very good at this, but it's the really lovely... like, very family dynamic where you've got the one relative who's trying really hard and the rest of the family who just, like, pretends that everything is great about it because they appreciate the effort, right? So even though Margot has to go get the electric knife to, like, saw through this whatever meat thing that he has made, they all eat it and they all tell him he did a great job, which I think is just lovely and such a caring family.
Yeah, the family is very loving, and the structure of it, how the role that the, each of them plays in it is very clear. In fact, I think that one of the things that's most interesting to me about Margot is how clear the film is that she has really taken on the mantle of oldest sister as a sort of mom substitute.
Yes.
And I wonder what you think about that, given that, you know, one of the big critiques of kind of fairy tale or rom-com story structure is that oftentimes the young women at the center have lost their mother and are only left with a father figure to teach them how to move through the world. But in this case, they have the father figure that helps them move through the world, but they also have their sister stepping up to take on this, like, surrogate mom role. I mean, how do you take that on, given that there's a lot of critiques about always killing the mom in these stories?
Yeah, like, you can never have... Yeah, either you can't have your mother, you can't have either parent.
Yes.
But I think that... that having the three sisters is a really interesting way of kind of, I guess, still using that the dead mother trope, but, like, still showing that there's, like, a really strong female bond, and showing that you've got this older sister. But what's really interesting for Laura Jean is that Margot leaves at the beginning, right? So Margot's only in the first, like, you know, 15 minutes of the movie before she has to leave. And so you kind of have this, like, memory of Margot, but then the person who's actually looking up for Laura Jean is her younger sister.
Right.
Which is super interesting. And so Kitty, the youngest sister, is, like, a force to be reckoned with. And she's the one who kind of takes on this... You would think that, you know, Margot would pass it on to Laura Jean, that Laura Jean's supposed to take care of Kitty while she's gone, but it's really kind of the other way around, that Kitty ends up taking care of Laura Jean while Margot is away. And of course, because she's only 11, it's misguided, or it's well-intentioned, but, you know, she's the one who sends all of these letters.
Right. So in this case, you know, the mothering that Kitty does for Lara Jean is to kind of shove her like a baby bird off the branch into the world of romantic relationships.
Yes.
And one and throughout the film, we're told this a lot, that people worry about her, including her father, including her friends, including her eventual love interest, who we'll get to, Peter Kavinsky, that she has not made that step into actually having romantic relationships, despite loving romance novels and loving like writing very romantic letters and stories. But I don't know. What do you think about that as a convention? Does Laura Jean need that push? Is it so important for her to get out there and be romantic, even if it's not necessarily the thing that she wants to do?
No, I mean, I think that it's, you know, her sister really wants her. Well, okay, so when she and her father go later, and her father kind of like recognizes that she's going through a hard time, and he takes her to the diner where he and her mother kind of like went as they were dating and would hang out, he admits that he's kind of leaned on the two older girls the most. And it kind of sets up a little bit that Laura Jean has maybe dealt with the loss of her mother, maybe not as easily as Margot has. Like, Margot took up this mantle of, like, I am now the older sister, like, I'm gonna step up. And Kitty was so young. But for Laura Jean, she's the one who's, I think, struggling with not having this mother at this particular time of her life the most, or at least because she's the main character, we're seeing it the most. And she, I mean, you see her other two sisters, like they're very, very outgoing. And so with Laura Jean, who's a little bit more of an introvert, she really leans on her sister. And so when her sister has left, I think that Kitty does think it's important for her to like have more friends or like find some other outlet. Right? Because remember at the movie, at the beginning of the movie, she says that like Margot's the person she sits with every day at lunch. Like, her older sister is the one that she sits with every day at lunch. Like, she doesn't really have many other friends other than like Josh and her very bizarre friend Chris, who we should definitely talk about. Who is always flaking on her.
And eating Subway
And
per
eating
sponsorship
Subway,
contract.
yeah, of course, of course. Spokesperson for Subway. Yeah, but she, you know, she doesn't have someone that she sits with at lunch regularly. And you know, as misguided as Kitty's actions are, this like drama in Laura Jean's life kind of, she makes friends with Lucas because of it. Her relationship with Chris, I think, actually gets a little bit stronger. She regains her friendship with Josh to good or better, because I don't know how I feel about Josh.
Before we dive into the boys, the titular boys in this film, I do want to take one second to ask you this question. And it is, why do you think movies like this and stories like this kill the mother? I mean, in this film, they've clearly kind of acknowledged that that's a move that they've made because they replace that maternal influence with Lara Jean's sisters. But why, what function do you think it serves in these stories to kill the mom for the good, I suppose, of our romantic lead?
I think when you don't have the mother character, it implies this idea that the main character is somehow on their own in some way, or that they're like slightly unmoored. And so I think that like not only do they kill the mother in the movie, they also take away the surrogate mother, right? Like, by killing the mother, they've made Margot this like surrogate mother character. And then in the first 15 minutes, Margot has to go away to Scotland. And so Laura Jean is like completely adrift, right? She doesn't have that mo like either mother figure. And so that kind of gives like Kitty room to then be like, well, I know what's right for you, and to send all these letters. It gives you this character of Laura Jean who, yeah, she's kind of afraid. She fears being abandoned in some way. Like, at some point she says, if I don't tell him how I feel, then I won't have to know how he feels, and then it doesn't matter if he leaves or not. Right? So I think this like fear of abandonment, and also like being very apprehensive to become close to people who you don't already know are there for you, right? Like, she's so close to her family because she knows them and they've always been there. And I think she feels comfortable with Josh because they're next door neighbors and they've known each other for so long. But these other people, she's much more insecure about, like, what kind of function they will serve in her life. So Kitty, like, pushing her out of the nest is actually a really important moment. But I think that, like, that's why this, like, falling back on this, like, you don't have a mother function in these fairy tale type movies is to give you that like, oh, this character is feeling some kind of, like, isolation or fear of abandonment and has to go, at some point, like, search outside of their house, right? And so you already have, like, she doesn't have a mother, and then when Margot leaves, it's like, oh, now she definitely has to, like, leave the nest.
Right. It is very funny because I think you're absolutely right that it sets up Lara Jean in a kind of internal conflict where she's on a journey. And yeah. And it's an emotional and personal journey, which is very intriguing. It's like a hero. I guess it's like, in some ways, I mean, if we want to, we can make the argument, and I think I will, that the hero's journey is theorized centrally around a male character. But in this case, yeah. we have a very classically female hero's journey, which is an internal journey, an emotional journey, a relational journey.
Yeah.
And it is funny how the film constantly points at that being about the feminine. I mean, in part also because her dad, John Corbin, is a gynecologist.
Oh, yes.
And talks to her about sex very frankly. They talk about menstruation at one point in the movie, at which point Kitty has one of my favorite lines where
yes.
their dad isn't sure why Lara Jean's acting so strangely. And Kitty says, it's her moon day. And their dad says, the periods are a natural biological process. They have nothing to do with the moon. And then Kitty says, the internal goddess inside says it's my most powerful time of the month.
And you just know that his house is overrun by women all the time. Because there's that one scene where Chris, Lara Jean's friend, comes and she's like, so why did you decide to become a gynecologist? Like, when you were an undergrad in college, like, what made you think, I want to look at vaginas all day? Like, that poor man. Like...
Yeah, it's kind of like an assault of, like, the capital F feminine in, like, a second wave feminist yes. sense, which is pretty hilarious considering that the film has done this sort of, like, deep feminine wound to Lara Jean on a psychoanalytical level.
But I like him as a dad, though, because, like, you know, he's raised three incredibly strong girls who I then assume have very strong female friends. And you never see him, like, the one time where Peter Gavinsky takes her to a party, you know, he says the typical father, like, no drinking, no driving, or, like, no drugs, like, you know, no whatever. But it's not, like, he doesn't play that, like, overly protective father, you know? And he's the one who actually encourages her to go to the party with Peter Gavinsky. He's not like, you can't go to parties with boys, you know? So he's like a really nice father and being like, these girls can take care of themselves. And like, yes, I'm their father and I want them to be safe, but I'm not going to hold them back. As a response to 10 Things I Hate About You, where the father is ridiculously overprotective.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. And this actually takes us to a really important thing with this film, too, which is that it is so self-aware that it is a quote unquote high school rom-com, that it is responding directly to the whole legacy of the high school rom-com, including 10 yes. Things I Hate About You and the whole John Hughes canon and every 90s high school rom-com. So keeping that in mind, I think it's time now to talk about how this movie and specifically its romantic lead, the inimitable Peter Kavinsky subvert the traditional high school rom-com tropes. So, Maida, now's your moment. Tell us about Peter Kavinsky.
Oh, I mean, I love Peter Kavinsky. I think he's so sweet, and he's got a heart of gold. And I like that he plays the, like, jock who is nice, but not in, like, a, oh, look, like, jocks can be nice too, but he's like a fully fleshed out, like, well-rounded character who, you know, enters into this agreement with Lara Jean and is really respectful of her. And like, I think he like pushes her boundaries a little bit, but in like a nice and healthy way, and he never pushes her like so far. And when she says no to things, like, he is quite respectful.
He is a surprisingly respectful character, especially considering that they enter into a classic of the high school rom-com trope, which is the arranged fake relationship.
Oh, yes. What a good trope.
Oh, boy. But in this case, as you say, like, it's completely based on a literal, like, consent contract between them.
Yes.
That they write together.
Yep. Yeah, you know, he laughs a little bit when she says that they're going to write a contract, but he doesn't say, like, oh, we don't need that, or, oh, like, don't you trust me? Like, he understands that that's something that, like, is a good thing that they should do and that she clearly needs. And so, yeah, I think that that's like a really nice scene that they make this contract, and especially since her first rule is like, you cannot kiss me. Mm-hmm. And even though he, you know, objects in the way that like, how will people believe that we're in a relationship? He lets her give him an alternative, which is the funniest alternative, which is that he can stick his hand in her back pocket. Which I think is lovely.
And she says that the reason why he can do it is because it's the opening shot in 16 Candles, which is a hilarious meta moment of the movie recognizing its own relationship to the history of the high school rom-com, which I, like, as a nerd, delighted in completely.
I know. 16 Candles, I hate that movie, though. But I like it is. I like that they keep, like, one main kind of one that they're constantly referencing mm-hmm. and going back to.
Well, and they even speak really frankly. I mean, it's a short conversation, but they talk really frankly about the racism yes. in 16 Candles. There's a scene where Peter and Lara Jean are watching 16 Candles, the scene with the racist stereotype in it. And, you know, they say, yeah, this is super racist.
Yeah, it's actually Peter who brings it up. I mean, you know, Peter is with Kitty and Lara Jean, two Asian women. And he says, excuse me, isn't this kind of racist? And Lara Jean says, this is exceptionally racist. which I think, yeah, it's an interesting moment to, you know, say like, yes, we recognize that this is a landmark of like teenage cinema, but we are going to remind you that there is this racism here that we're kind of responding to by creating our own, you know, teenage high school rom-com with Asian women as the leads, which is really lovely. So it's like Absolutely. A direct response.
And I think there are other things in the film that are really, that are direct responses to earlier high school rom-coms too. Like, for example, the whole plot with the arranged fake relationship, in those, typically before this movie, the idea there is that one or the other person in the relationship is being deceived somehow. But in this case, they're just deceiving the people around them. They're having perfect communication about the terms of the situation themselves for the most part.
True.
And we see them even develop a relationship based on emotional vulnerability, not vulnerability that we're told about, but vulnerability that we're shown, yes. instead of some kind of like unspoken power dynamic based on one or the other's popularity or some kind of sexual attraction. It's really a true, like the conversation they have in the diner about each other's parents and the traumas that they've experienced was really genuinely beautiful.
Yeah, one of my favorite lines is when they're talking about her mother and then Peter's father, and Peter says, oh yeah, but it's whatever. And Lara Jean responds, it's not whatever. We don't have to talk about it, but it's not whatever. And I think that's really nice because in that, you know, in that moment, she tells him, like, I know that this is not something you're comfortable talking about, but like, you are allowed to have feelings about that, and those feelings are valid. Which is so nice. And then when you know, when she goes to his house for dinner later, he is open to talking to her more about his family, which is really nice. And yeah, like you said, that we are actually shown how they become closer and how they bond, as opposed to it just being like, oh, by the way, they grew really close through this montage, yeah. through this montage to like great music, which is typically what used to happen in the teenage rom-coms.
Mm-hmm. They bonded together over an activity.
Yeah.
Now they're in love.
They went and played paintball and now they're in love.
Yeah. And I think that in that way, this movie is a really beautiful example of a Gen Z kind of ethic and an aesthetic yes. in the sense that it's really selling you what some people call radical softness, which is this way of acknowledging that the world is really hard, but loving and cultivating softness and vulnerability and kindness in yourself and others, which I believe, and I've seen it in my students, and I know you have too, is the
yes.
one of the central ethics of Gen Z for good and for ill.
Yes. And I think that like that's one of my favorite parts is that, like I said, that they push each other, but they never push each other too hard. Like there aren't a lot of conversations where they end up like yelling at each other. And even when Lara Jean like confronts Jen, there's not a lot of like saying like Jen is a passive aggressive jerk, but there's not a lot of like cruelty. Like they don't say mean, horrible things to each other, which I think is also really nice.
And in that scene, we get Jen admitting that the reason why she's acting like such a passive aggressive yes. jerk is because Lara Jean hurt her very specifically yeah. at a very specific time in a very specific way.
I think one of the only moments that like is kind of this, you know, kind of one of these weird pushy moments is when Peter Kavinsky comes to her house, you know, because he actually, you know, they have that situation that happens at the hotel during the ski trip. And Laura Jean keeps telling him to go away. And of course, Peter Kavinsky wants to give his side of the story, but he never yells at her. He never kind of like tries to trap her or grab her to get her to listen to him. He always just like respectfully comes and like, can I talk to you? Where she just says no. But Josh, like, I guess seeing this from his house, comes and is like, you know, telling Peter to go away. But he doesn't let Laura Jean just deal with it. Because Laura Jean even tells Josh to, like, back off. And, of course, Josh starts yelling at Peter. And it's, like, becomes this argument between, like, Josh and Peter. Which is, like, not what that should be. So it's one of the reasons why I'm, like, not a huge fan of Josh. Because I think he's a little self-centered. I know he's going through a lot, but still.
Well, but I think your point is well made. And I think it also indicates another, yet another way that the movie is engaging with the history of high school rom-coms. Because Josh, in some ways, at the beginning of the film, I had forgotten this, but in this rewatch of it, Josh is really kind of set up at first as the, you know, obvious romantic interest for Lara Jean.
Yes.
He was her friend. He's kind of distant. He's kind of moody. He's got that kind of romantic lead look to him. And he's the underdog.
Yeah.
In some ways. He's not the super popular guy. And then Peter Kavinsky is the super popular jock. But it turns out, funnily enough, that he's actually, you know, a softie. He's totally soft. He's not even just soft on the inside. He's soft on the outside and the inside. And so the film is making kind of a radical shift there where it's showing that, like, hey, you know, just because someone is popular or someone is the underdog doesn't mean automatically that they're going to fit with you because they make sense with your high school archetype.
Yeah, and it actually, you reminded me also that there's a point where Josh really doesn't like Peter Kavinsky, right? We get, like, many hints to that he thinks Peter Kavinsky's a jerk, and he really doesn't like him because he's a jock, which kind of makes you think, like, oh, he falls into this typical jock group. But when Laura Jean becomes friends with Peter Kavinsky, she even says that she begins to become friends with his friends, and that even though they're not, like, people she has hung out with, she begins liking hanging out with them. And his friends are actually really nice people, right? And so you're getting to see this group of, like, the jock, the quote-unquote jock group, but in, like, a nice way. And you're seeing that, like, Josh in some way is, like, prejudiced towards them, just like I guess they are prejudiced towards him, but just because they're fitting into these teenage archetype groups and that's what they feel like they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes me wonder a lot about what, both where and why these archetypes came about. Because, of course, like, you don't enter high school, like, in Mean Girls and get assigned a table where you belong. And yet these movies sort of make high school seem that way. So there's clearly an allure to that kind of story, that kind of thinking about high school. So it makes me wonder why that comes up so much.
I think it's the extracurricular activities. You know, like, I just feel like, oh, it depends on, like, what you do outside of, like, normal school hours, then decides, like, who your friends are and who you sit with during school hours. So if you, like, play a sport, then you end up hanging out with sports kids. And if you, I don't know what Josh does in his free time, like, listen to music. He, like, hangs out with those kids. But yeah, this, like, archetype, the like, teenage groups is, like, such a, it's in every teenage movie, right? There's not a single one I can name where there's not, like, clear-cut groups.
Yeah, and I guess that just, like, feels good because it's easy to think about people in discrete categories, and as a writer, you can use a lot of shorthand, and then you just are supposed to sort of, like, know who these characters are. So I found that pleasing in these movies, that they were kind of, like, dodging that a little bit. They're still making it clear that there are cliques, but they're not investing in the, like, in the structure of that too much. I mean,
yeah.
It does make me think, too, about, like, why is the high school romance also so appealing within that, right? Because almost always these high school romances are relying on these crossing the group stereotypes. Right. So what's that about?
But you mentioned Pretty in Pink earlier. And, you know, since the movie is, like, a lot of references to the John Hughes movies, Pretty in Pink has a scene where he brings her to one of his parties, right? And the moment she, like, steps through the door, everyone at the party is like, you don't belong here. Mm-hmm. And it's so clear, right, that, like, the lines at this school are so, like, heavily drawn that, like, someone even walking into a party, there's, like, an instant reaction to it. Whereas in this movie, part of the contract is that she has to come with him to all of his, like, lacrosse parties and games, whatever that means. And when she does, it's not a big deal, right? Like, there's not, like, a big reaction. And if anything, her friend Lucas is there, right? It's like...
Right.
And Lucas, it's like, we're not giving any hint to, you know, what high school group he's supposed to fit in. And so you kind of just get, like, a smattering of different people, which is really nice, where you're like, oh, okay, this is not, like, this is a jock and mean popular girls party.
Yeah, and I think that the production design of the movie, which is stunning, oh, everyone. So if you're good. Putting off watching this, watch it for the production design, the direction, and the music. It's just...
Yes. And so shout good. Out, because the books were written by a Korean-American woman. The screenplay is written by, I believe, a Latinx American woman. And then it's directed by a woman as well. So, like powerhouse ladies on this project.
And boy, oh boy, can you tell. I mean, I feel like this is one of those movies where it hits you in the face that this is a film made from the perspective of women, and specifically women of color, who understand this girl. Yes. And her experiences.
And who grew up watching all of these, like, teenage movies and feeling just a little bit like, oh, we don't 100% relate to this, or we're a little bit locked out of this, and have now created their own film to, like, add themselves to this genre, which is so lovely. And, the whole production design is just gorgeous. I think it's even better in the second movie. Like, they were just kind of, like, experimenting in the first movie, and then they go, like, full on in the second movie. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah, I think in some ways the production design and how beautiful and thoughtful it all is really makes me think about this feminist concept called speculative presence or speculative future, the kind of idea of, like, doing the future that you want to see. And I feel like in some ways the artistic team for this movie created exactly what you're talking about, like the teen movie that they wanted as kids, which has, like, everyone wearing, like, super cool clothes, being really nice to each other. The music is banging. Racism comes up, but only insofar as you're critiquing it as a thing not acceptable in this particular community. And cultural difference comes up, but as something to be celebrated and to get excited about and to engage in together. It is very much like a little bit of this, like, high school utopia.
I do like that. She's not, like, one of the five people that she writes a letter to, like, doesn't have to be, like, another Asian person. Mm. Like, I like that there's not that kind of, like, oh, you're of one race, so, like, one of the people involved in your, like, romantic, like, triangle or whatever struggle, like, has to be someone of your same race, which I think is also interesting. And, like, although you do see that there are, like, other Asian Americans at her school, like, it's not like they don't exist, it's just that, like, she doesn't have to be in love with one of them. Which I think is really nice. And if anything, in the second movie, when there is another Asian American character who's a male character, he becomes a love interest of her friend Chris, which is also really fun. Was there something that you don't like about Peter Kavinsky? Because I know that, like, I love him and I get made so much fun of for liking Peter Kavinsky as much as I do. But I'm like, do you have any critiques of Peter?
Why do people make fun of you for liking Peter Kavinsky?
I don't know. I think it's because he's the jock character. And I think, like you said, that we're so stuck in these, like, archetypes. And that's why I think it'd be so interesting for us to talk about the second movie, because it really came up after the second movie came out about what kind of boy Laura Jean should be with. And the fact that, like a relationship with a jock is not one that would even last, which I think is really interesting and kind of shows, like, you know, how these, like, prejudices run both ways.
Well, and I think it also reflects, too, like, a weird philosophy that comes up in these high school movies, which is, like, the guy you date in high school is going to set the tone for the rest of your life, which, yes. Like, Jesus Christ, that better not be fucking true.
Oh, yeah, I hope not. That would be horrible. And I also, like, I do want to also point out that, like, one of the things I think is a little, mostly just because of what happens in the second movie, but I think that people have this idea of, like, oh, you have to meet someone who matches you and, like, has to be interested in the same things as you. So, like, Laura Jean, like, loves to read. I think she's a writer. She likes to write. And so, like, she has to be with someone who also likes those things or who is maybe, like, also just as smart as her in those ways. Mm-hmm. And I think it's nice to have a relationship with, like, a diversity of talents and that, like, you don't – that, like, maybe that there's, like, this hidden thing of, like, oh, well – you know, Laura Jean shouldn't be smarter than the person she dates or better at school than the person she dates. But it's really lovely when Kitty brings her the box of notes that Peter's been writing to her through the whole year. And there's one where he's like, I love having such a smart girlfriend. Everyone was so impressed with you during your English presentation. You know, so he like appreciates like how smart she is, which I think is awesome.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I respond to in their relationship, to your point, is that the reason why Laura Jean should like Peter, the argument that the film makes for us, is not that she can have his cultural capital. It's not that he's a rich kid or he's the valedictorian or he's you know, the most popular guy in school. It's because he's really sweet and he cares about her.
Yes.
That's the reason we're given for why she should be with him.
Yeah, we're not given that, like, he, yeah, that he brings something else that she needs. But she just actually needs someone to be nice to her and to be understanding with where she is at, right? That she's not ready for this, like, typical high school dating scenario and that he's, like, patient and kind and just really likes her.
Right, she's, like, the opposite of most high school rom-com leads in the sense that she's not like against relationships, but she's also not desperate for one either. She's in, yes, a kind of like liminal space that I think is actually really true to what girls that age go through. If they're attracted to boys in particular, it's probably different for girls who are queer.
Yeah. But the, yeah, that fear of like what a relationship would be like in real life when you don't have that experience yet, I think is very, I think that is so easily identified with, which is what makes this such a good teen movie.
And it sets a tone for all of the movies to follow this one this month, which will surely disappoint us greatly after this very sweet and thoughtful
starting strong and rolling downhill.
Yeah, it's kind of great. We're starting with a movie that is like encapsulating the legacy of all these movies, and then we're going to work backwards and look at the ones that came before it and be like, oh God, but why though?
I'm going to be so afraid if you end with 16 Candles, because that for me is at the bottom of the hill.
Stay tuned, listeners. Stay tuned. To all the high school movies we loved before, but don't anymore. Awesome. Okay, well, let's transition. It's about that time. I want to thank all of our listeners. We've gotten a lot of new listeners in the last 2 weeks. We're so excited to have you aboard. And we love making this podcast for you. But we have a very special thank you to our supporters on Patreon, who are eternallyboard/Trey, Robert, Esther, Bob, and Sean. This podcast literally would not happen without you. And if you're interested in becoming a patron to get some fun behind-the-scenes content and extra bonuses, you can go to patreon.com/romcomkilljoys. Just so you know, if you're new to our Killjoy family, we put out new episodes every Thursday, and you can join the community in the conversation the other 6 days of the week by joining us on social media. So make sure you follow us on Facebook and Instagram at romcomkilljoys, and now you can even find us on YouTube, which is pretty great. So if you need to catch up, our first 4 episodes are up on YouTube now. All of that being said, now we have some things that you can indulge in while you're waiting for our next episode, obviously. Maida, what are your antidotes for To All the Boys I've Loved Before?
Okay, so my, well, because To All the Boys is wonderful, I don't think you need an antidote to it. It's not poisoning you. But my suggestion for if you like books, because To All the Boys is written by a woman of color, so my suggestion is Eid was this week, so Eid Mubarak to anybody who celebrated Eid this week. But as a series of books called the Devabad Trilogy, and the first book is called City of Brass. It's by an author named S.A. Chakraborty. The initials are the first name, S.A., and then last name is Chakraborty. And it's an incredible like fantasy fiction series that is entirely set in the Islamic world. And so it has really amazing portrayals of Islamic characters Middle Eastern mythology and as well as Islam and how those two mix together. So it's absolutely an incredible series. And I would encourage anyone who's interested in fantasy or, you know, just reading something different because it's so different from anything else I've read thus far. And it's incredible. So that's my big suggestion for this week.
I have two antidotes, or maybe to Maida's point, supplements. Supplements for this
supplements.
Movie. I would recommend first, there's a really fun and very sweet and very Gen Z Netflix series that just came out called Say I Do, Surprise Weddings. And there's one episode, it's the fifth episode of the season that they have out called Kindergarten Crush. And it's about two young people who met as five-year-olds and then went their separate ways and came back again as adults. And it's just a very sweet story of people who, you know, really had that childhood spark, just like Lara Jean, and then reconnected with someone in a really sweet way. And it gets into some really great stuff about, like, imagination and class, and it's just a beautiful little escape and very romantic. And then I would also recommend a book called Pigs in Heaven by Barbara Kingsolver. It's a little bit outdated in its politics now, but it's a really moving, fascinating, complicated portrayal of transracial adoption, you know, being the parent of a child who you don't share native culture with, and also some really tricky politics that are not covered enough in our culture, like native rights, you know, parental rights and adoption, things like that. And I think it's a really good example of a story about a mother and a child in this case, where, you know, a cultural difference is being navigated with love and respect and complexity. And I think it supplements well that theme in that subtle theme in To All the Boys I've Loved Before as well. Maida, thanks so much for coming on here. See, you didn't need to be scared. I didn't say anything bad about Peter Kavinsky.
I was so afraid. I was ready to fight for Peter Kavinsky. I'm glad I didn't have to.
No, he's you know, he's not my cup of, dark, dark, dark coffee, but, you know, I'll take it. I'll take it. He just added a little sugar cube to my weekly dose. That's all. All right, Maida, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram. If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys. Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog. And the song you're listening to now is a cover of one of my favorites, Baby Love by Colin Langanis. Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy. Not a rom-com, not me, not anyone. See you next time.
Don't throw our love away. In my arms, why don't you stay?